just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Eight 18 here on a Thursday, transition Thursday. You know, it's interesting. Angie Morgan, interesting girl, and you know, there's so much experience, especially over the course of what, the last 15 years. I mean, the experiences that I don't care what you were in the Marine Corps. If you stayed around any amount of time, you became a non-commissioned officer. If you came in as an officer, obviously the experiences you have, and if you were a little bit more senior, an NCO and a staff NCO. But the experiences that we have as a group leading millennials, nobody has the experiences we have. And so to me, one of the interesting things about when I listen to Angie is simply is listening to her talk about how you package it, how you keep from blasting your foot off. Because we're proud, and I think most of us aren't shy about talking about it if people want to know. But again, I think it is kind of an interesting part of the dialogue relative to post-conflict life, how much you share, what you should share. I think most people are pretty guarded about what they do. I was surprised, and I'll reiterate a point. I was surprised, however, when I did kind of ping my friends and ask them for advice, and they said, yeah, I'll give you some advice. Do not talk about your experiences. It's they say they want to hear them, but that's not really the case. So I was a bit taken aback by how many of my friends told me that. And so I asked them about it. I engaged each one of them about that. And and kind of had a little bit of a deeper conversation with them about it. So I just find it interesting. So it is a it's an interesting part of transitioning, and if you don't go to an occupation that's familiar with it. So if you go into the security business, they're familiar with it, right? A lot of those guys are veterans, are familiar with conflict. But if you go into a part of the civilian sector that's not familiar with it, you know what I mean? You're an anomaly, and they are nervous about it, and so. I was just surprised at how prevalent it seemed to be in terms of the comments that guys made to me. We're joined. In fact, our next guest is a bit of an example about that. Steve, pronounce your last name so I don't butcher it, because I get really nervous doing it.
My last name is Seeker.
Seeker.
Yeah, but as long as you're not calling me any four-letter words, I'm usually
well,
pretty good.
I'm actually more comfortable calling you four-letter words than I am pronouncing your last name.
And you know what? They'd probably be more appropriate.
Thank you. So Steve Kerr. Now, let me just tell you how I crossed paths with Steve. Somebody that everybody's heard on the program is Rudy, right? Kurt Knowles, former F-18 pilot. And Rudy is absolutely... he's a battle buddy of mine from Afghanistan, and a great friend. But one of the things he's done here at All Marine Radio is, he's kind of a technical advisor to us. And when, everybody knows the problems, in fact, we just went over them. 72 of the 280 Marine Corps F-18s are operational today. Pretty incredible number. In fact, that was on December 31st. I would venture to say today the number's lower, not higher. Sobering. But anyway, whenever we have a mishap or something that needs to be explained, part of Knowles' job as a technical advisor here is he comes on and he explains it. You know, we don't speculate on the crash or anything like that because I think we're all grown-ups and we all know how to stay in our lane until investigations get done. But what he does do is talk about this is what he's doing up there during that kind of an operation, whether you're flying close air support at night up at McCaxey, whether you're doing Blue Angel stuff in Nashville at a very low level,
right.
You know, the things that tend to happen, he's, you know, explainer in chief here. So anyway, Noel sends me a text. Hey man, I got a guy you got to talk to. I'm like, okay, who is it? He says, his name's Steve. He said, I ran into him at football practice. And we started talking, both Marines, and it goes from there. But he said his story is a pretty interesting one, from scout sniper to law enforcement to Marines gone Hollywood. So Steve joins us now. And Steve, before we get going and before we tell your story, let me just complete a thought and ask your opinion.
Sure.
You're a scout sniper. You get out. Does the civilian world want to know about your experiences? Because sniper's a pretty sexy job. Like Angie talked about, do you have to be really careful in terms of what you let them look into in terms of that job?
Well, yeah. Well, first off, I was at day one for, I've been through regimental school, been to SEER school, been to a bunch of MSPF, Maritime Special Purpose Force schools and things like that. But I never did, I got out before I went to division school to get the secondary MLS. So just for clarification, because I know guys out there from our community would be real hot on that. So just want to be upfront with that. But when you get out, and people ask where you served or what you've done, the state platoons and the sniper platoons, you know, everybody assumes that, at the time that I was in, I mean, there weren't a lot of combat operations going on, but everybody assumes that there's some sort of, like, red telephone in your bedroom and, like, you know, you get a call from the president in the middle of the night, and the black helicopters show up, and you know, next thing you know, it's like an episode of 24 or something like that.
Right. It's not that way?
No, it's not, which is kind of really a buzzkill for me because that's what my recruiter told me. So, but, so I think like, you know, most people in the civilian world aren't, regardless of what your job is in the Marine Corps, I think, they just aren't prepared to deal with, like, they don't think like we do. So I think that's always, and that's a very difficult thing for a Marine who's transitioning to recognize and to adjust to. Like, you don't get it. You're like, what's wrong with these people? Like, why are they so friggin' lazy? Why are they so worthless? You know? And, these people don't want to work hard. They don't want to, you know, there's no integrity. There's no character. What is this place that I find myself in? That was for me the most difficult part, I think. When I stepped out of the Marine Corps.
All right. No, it's just interesting because there's a cultural gap, and I've heard people say don't say anything about it. And if they ask, don't tell them. Up some pleasantry because they're very nervous about the whole PTSD. And when you say the word Marine, as much as we want to think that it's all good, after they sit down and think about it, the thought will go through their head, I wonder if. And so they said, look, just I'm telling you for self-preservation reasons. But you went in the law enforcement business, so a lot different. So let's learn about you, Steve.
Sure.
All right. Born and raised where?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So yes, last weekend I wanted to punch Tom Brady in the face. because they beat the Steelers.
Hammered them. They didn't just beat them.
Yeah.
Come on, they beat them up.
Come on.
Come on, man.
Let's get real. You don't have to rub it in.
Come on. You got to take your salt in the wound like everybody else. Tom Brady is pretty much the man, all right? There's no – how about that performance, though? Unbelievable.
I hate him, but I love him. You know what I mean? Like, I hate him for – I'm tired of hearing about Tom Brady. But the dude's just undeniable. I mean, you don't perform like that under pressure and mount a comeback, if you're not just if not the greatest quarterback, to date. You know what I mean? I mean, the dude's a leader right there, man. Total stud.
You know what? He reminds me of, I did some work, relative to combat decision making, and
right.
I read an article in I think it's called Military Review that was put out by the Army. What is it? I want to say it might be the Army War College.
Okay.
And there was an article in it called "Expert Warfighters with Battlefield Vision," and what they called it was that this whole thing that we would like to believe is intuitive, there's no such thing as battlefield intuition. You study it, you learn it, and in that way, when things begin to happen, you have a very, very good idea of what's going to happen because you've studied it and studied it and studied it. And you see things that other people don't see. And to me, that's Tom Brady. I mean, he's a student of it. And when he got it going a little bit at the start of the third quarter, the balls he threw into traffic were right exactly where they needed to be. And it was like, he was like a surgeon getting after it. And that comes with hard work, even at that level. I mean, it does pay off. It's not an accident.
No, he was thrown into double coverage and kind of threading the needle and things. It reminds me, I don't know if have you ever read the book, Blink, by Malcolm Gladwell?
You know, I've read pieces of it.
It reminds me of, what he talks about. You know, it's like the whole title of that book is The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. And just what you were talking about, what Tom Brady was doing is, that's the term thin slicing, that he uses in that book. And it's like, he's able to find patterns in what's going on, in these like very short, you know, he doesn't have to take a lot of information in because he's been there before. He's worked these problems before so much. So he has these narrow windows, and based on all of his training and experience, he's able to make these really, really quick, accurate decisions. It's pretty, because he knows he's finding the patterns, and he, like you said, he's anticipating because he spent so much time solving these problems.
You know, I read when I first started researching decision making. It's kind of an interesting aside to the interview here. There's a lot of stuff that had been written about firefighters. I can't remember the guy's name. His name's Gary something that was doing is that, as you accumulate more and more experience, what you're able to do is, you're able to eliminate 90% of the courses of action. You're able to, you know, scope that down to the 10% that you need to focus on, and then from there you might need another data point or two to make the good decision, and the perfect one, but a good one, and then you evolve it from there, and that's what decisive guys do. And a lot of the research was done on firefighters, but I mean the name of it was recognition prime decision making, and the example that I used to use with lieutenants was tic-tac-toe, right? And I had this little diagram like, okay, what's X's next move, right? And you look at it and you're like, oh, there. Well, how do you know that? Well, you paid hours and hours and hours of tic-tac-toe with a brother or sister so that you know that when you see that, this is the right response without going through all the analytics of, well, this, if this, that, 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 that.
Right.
And
right,
so
right.
It's interesting how the brain works relative to that. And, I'm not sure how we got going on that, but
I don't either. But
oh no, yeah. We're talking about Tom Brady. You hate him. Yeah. You're from Pittsburgh. All right, next question. How does the Marine Corps get? How does the Marine Corps get on your radar as a young guy?
Well, my grandfather was in the Army in World War II, and he was in the 28th Infantry Division, which was a Pennsylvania Army National Guard unit that was activated for World War II. It's actually the oldest division-sized unit, I think, in the armed forces of the United States, because some of the units can trace their lineage back to Benjamin Franklin's battalion.
Right.
Which was called the Pennsylvania Associators. See, I did a little research. So.
Holy smokes, listen to that.
Yeah, so there you go. How do you like that? So,
I'm impressed.
But yeah, so my grandfather was a forward observer with 28th Infantry and was calling in, calling in artillery fires and that sort of thing. D-Day guy, I think he went ashore at D+2, was when he finally made it ashore on Omaha Beach. So he didn't do D-Day, but D+2, and then fought all the way, to the end of the war.
He didn't. So he didn't do. Did you hold that against him that he didn't do? Like, come on, Grandpa.
I did. I was like, what? Jesus, man.
What's up with skipping out on D-Day, man?
What's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you? Oh man! You know, I interviewed a guy who was a ranger that day who went up the cliffs at Point du Hoc.
Right, right.
And his brother was in a tank regiment, and he saw his brother. He sees his brother the next day, or 2 days later, as they're beginning to move inland. He said, "Look, we were close to this road, and we were taking a break, and here come these tanks." And I saw the markings, and I thought, well, maybe my brother. He said, "Look, in the second tank, here's my brother driving a tank." I said, "So what happened?" He said, "He pulled it over." We got to talk for about 15 or 20 minutes before they had to go. It's like,
cool.
Can you believe?
Cool.
Yeah, it's cool, but yeah,
of all the things, right?
So he's in the Army. So are you that grandson that has to tweak him and join the Marine Corps?
No, it wasn't even like that. It was kind of weird. Like, he honestly, he had a lot of problems. Like, he drank himself, to death. I mean, he battled alcoholism on and off from the war and had issues with that all throughout his life. And he never really talked about it very much. And when you would ask him, because I was really interested in history and military history and the military and thinking about service. And I would ask him, he would hardly ever say anything. And he certainly didn't describe any, very like detailed combat experiences or anything like that. And I don't know. I just got to thinking, I was looking at the Army. I was looking at volunteering for the Rangers. I was looking at this and that. And then, the more I read, I started reading about the Pacific Campaign, and I started kind of digging deeper into Marine Corps history, and back to the China Marines, back to the Banana Wars, all of that sort of stuff. And I'm like, And I just, what attracted me to the Marine Corps was, like, I don't need a beret. I don't need a special type. I don't need, like, this special name or this special unit or anything. Like, I'm a fucking Marine, dude. And, like, what attracted me to the Marines was, look, I'm not asking for you. I don't want you. Like, do you think you can measure up kind of thing? You know what I mean? Like, the recruiters were, like, dude, whatever. Like, you think you got what it takes? Where, like, the Army recruiters are like, oh, my God, like, they're like salesmen, and they were so hot on getting you in.
We have such a great pitch, don't we? Yeah, you can't.
Yeah,
you're probably not for us. Yeah, well, you need to go away and come back in a year.
You probably can't hang.
What?
And when I started reading about, Guadalcanal and the island campaigns and things like that, I was like, dude, like, this is, this to me, that to me at that age, you know, was like, that was the ultimate, like the lineage, the warrior lineage, the history there, and just, I mean, everywhere you look, all the way back to, you know, not to be a complete dork, but all the way back to the shores of Tripoli, I mean, we've been kicking ass and taking names.
So you you took the Kool-Aid and didn't drink it, like you took it intravenously.
No, yeah, like I snorted it and slammed it. No joke. I walked into the recruiter's office, and this was after watching like Sands of Iwo Jima and like Heartbreak Ridge on like loop. I walked into the recruiter's office.
Oh my god!
And I told him, like, because my parents didn't want to sign for it. Like, I was 17; they didn't want to sign for that.
They think you're like a little kook running around. You ain't going through this little Marine Corps thing.
Yeah, they're like, no, we're not doing that. You go to college, dude. I was doing well in school. They went to college. Like, that's what people in my neighborhood did.
Right.
You know, you go to college. And honest to God, like, my my mentality at the time was, yeah, fuck college. Fuck, you know, fuck officers, man. They don't do any work. Like,
Whoa!
I want to be a gunner.
Hey, back the truck up, man. Are you trying to get your shit thrown off Almery Radio by saying that? What? Although gunner sergeant is the coolest job in the Marine Corps.
So, you know, that was my mentality. It was like, I want to be gunny highway. Like, I want to be gunny striker.
We all do.
Yeah, you know, so I walked into the recruiter's office, no shit, and I said, hey, how are you doing? Da-da-da, I'm so-and-so, whatever. And, hey, I want to join the Marine Corps, and I want to be in infantry. I graduate on June 12th. How soon can I be in Parris Island after that? And this guy looked at me like, hey, slow down there, hard charger. Like,
slow down, turbo.
We haven't even taken the ASVAB test yet, bro. So let's slow down. And I'm like, what's the ASVAB? You know? But the only thing the guy sold me on was doing the, God, what, I can't even remember what the hell they call it, but he sold me on a six-year enlistment instead of a four-year enlistment. So it's like, you got this thing, you got clean background, you know, security force thing, terrorism and all that kind of stuff. So I was like, okay, cool. That sounds good. Like, I mean, I'm going to be in for 25 years anyway. So 6 years, 4 years, what's the difference? Right.
Right.
Yeah. So I shipped out to Parris Island like 2 weeks after I graduated high school. 03 guarantee kind of security force thing. And, hit Parris Island. I'd never even been on an airplane before. I flew to South Carolina, got on the bus, and, you know, they took us to the island. And, it was like super quickly. Like, I won't go into the whole yellow footprints and all that kind of. I mean, we all know, we've all been there, we've all done that.
You can, and come on. We never get tired of talking about it. We love it. It's the best, man.
Here's what I will say. The one thing that I did that always makes me laugh about this experience is, you know, it's that whole shock to the system. Like, you're slammed together with a bunch of dudes you don't know, and you're in this shit sandwich, right?
Right.
There was this guy on the bus, like the typical tool, man. And you always have one. Like, he's already got his head shaved. He's wearing a Marine Corps t-shirt. He's like, my brother's in the Marine Corps, and he's the know-it-all. Like, right. He knows everything. Like, I'm just sitting there, like, I got my little packet under my armpit, and I'm just all quiet, like, holy shit, man. Like, I hope they don't kill me. Yeah. You know, like, this kid's like, okay, well, this is what's going to happen next. They're going to do this, and they're going to do that, and trying to take charge of the platoon and stuff like that. And he keeps talking while we're on the bus. Like, we're all driving across the causeway to the island. Man, I'm quiet. I'm shitting my pants. I'm like, man, this is about to get real, right? And this kid's just running his mouth the entire time. Like, he knows exactly how it's going to go and everything, da-da-da-da-da, whatever. This dumb son of a bitch, man, they ripped him apart. as soon as he got off the bus because he had a Marine Corps t-shirt on. Yeah. And two weeks later, he quit. Like, he was gone.
What?
He was gone, dude. He was gone. He was one of those guys like, oh, my back hurts so bad. I don't know if I can take it. Come on, man. We've been walking 5 miles. So.
You know what? We love those stories. I remember my guy was a guy named Lou Gargano. He gets off the plane at National Airport in D.C., and he's got his hair spiked. He's from New York City. He's got his hair spiked. He's got a little blue bag with Marines spray painted on the side of it, and then a T-shirt that he stenciled Marines on. And he gets off the plane, and he comes walking up. And I remember Staff Sergeant, like, looks, and the guy says, my name is Lou Gargano. And the Staff Sergeant looks at me, he's like, why are you talking to me? Like, what do you, I'm here to report to Officer Candidate School. And the Staff Sergeant looks at him, and he says, what's your name? And he gives him his name again. He looks down at the clipboard. And he checks his name. He said, you go into that bathroom right now. You take that shirt off. You put something else on. You zip that jacket up. You go in there. You wash your hair. Right? And I don't want to hear another word out of you. You understand me? And we're like, whoa. They wore him out.
Yeah.
You know, and he was a tough guy, right? Tough guy from New York City.
Right.
In two weeks, he got up one morning. He was sitting on his rack. He was crying. I
don't want to play no more.
I can't take it anymore. It's like, why are you fighting them? They're not gonna let up. Just do what they tell you to do. And ultimately he did, and ultimately he graduated. But what a funny story. My guest this morning on a Thursday, we talk transition, is Steve. Say your last name.
Yeah, Seeker.
Seeker. I'll get it right. It'll take me about another half hour. I'll get it right. Steve Seeker. Okay. And we're about, like, not even into the interview that's taken us a half hour already. So he's a Steeler. He's a Steeler fan in mourning. He's a recovering Paris Island guy. And we're talking about his career. So you know, because you're a little weirdo, you know you're going to be a grunt. And so you go, you do the security force thing, you do the sniper thing. At the end of the day, why don't you do 25 years?
I enlisted in 89, and I was in security forces when Desert Storm, when they fired the first shots, of Desert Storm. And it was like, okay, now the security force guys, hey, we're going to be combat replacement companies. And we're like, oh shit, we're going to go to war. And of course we don't go to war because it's over so quick. But I do get orders to Victor 1-4. I get out to Victor 1-4. We go back to the desert pretty much immediately, for a Westpac that we spend most of that time in the Middle East, training the Kuwaitis and doing that sort of thing. We did a little bit of stuff in Somalia on that first pump, but there weren't any missions. I ended up, we come back from that, I get promoted, I'm a sergeant, I'm a team leader. You know, everything's going well. But I'm just frustrated. There's just not, I think Willie Buell left. He was our S2. Officer who was kind of running the platoon at the time. We didn't have sniper employment officers back then. I think when he left, he was kind of like a mentor and, kind of a hero of mine. Like, I'd do anything for that guy. I still talk to that guy.
Yeah, he's a good dude.
But, we got a new two officer. I didn't really communicate well with him, and I just kind of just felt like I lost my mentor there. And then we went back overseas again, did a little bit of stuff in Somalia, but nothing crazy. And it was just like, man, I'm over it, dude. Like, we're not getting any missions. Like, I haven't found my culminating experience, and I was getting frustrated. And I think at the time, like, I look back at it now, and as a young man, like, all I needed was some staff NCO to kind of, like, take me under his wing and say, look, son, hey, everybody gets frustrated. This is how you work the system a little better and work it to your advantage. And this is how you'll, you know, reach your goals that, that you've set for yourself. But I'd gotten married and I was spending time away from home. And that's usually the downfall of all Marines. As soon as they get married,
exactly.
It's either the downfall or like, or the stalwart kind of the bulwark of your career. But, it was kind of, you know, I spent a lot of time away from home, and I'm like, you know what? I want to go back to school. Like,
right.
I think that I was interested in the officer route at that time, and I felt I wanted to go back and get my education like my parents told me I should have in the first place. I made the call. I was like, all right, I was in the zone for staff sergeant, and I, you know, it was like one of those things. Well, if I do re-enlist at that time, then, hey, man, I'm going to do 20.
Right.
I said, oh, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get my degree and I'm going to see, we'll see what's what. I'll either come back as an officer, and kind of do the Mustang thing.
Right.
Or, we'll just see what the world has waiting for me. So,
All right. I want to talk about transitioning with you on a road that takes you to law enforcement and then ultimately doing something pretty cool, which is technical advising in the TV business. Talk about your first transition out of the Marine Corps. Was it an easy one? Did you know what you wanted to do right away? Did the college thing, was that what you wanted to do? Were you prepared for it? Were you kind of making it up as you went? Talk to us about your first transition.
I think they called TAPS classes whatever.
TAPS class.
And I went to TAPS, and I was doing like every other guy was doing in there. I wasn't paying attention at all, man. We're like chewing Copenhagen and like cracking jokes and like, man, what's lunch? You know, are we going to get limo early or what? You know what I mean?
Right.
you know, these guys are up there talking and I'm collecting the paperwork, but I'm not really paying attention. I get out and I didn't go back to school immediately. My wife's employer at the time was a former Marine, a Vietnam vet. And, he's like, oh man, hey, you're going to get out. That's a really, you know, smart move. You know, I'll teach you business. Come work for me. I'll pay you what you're making as a sergeant. And I'll, you know, come and kind of intern at my company and my manufacturing company and learn business. And, I was kind of like, wow, that's crazy. Like that's, one of those things of, you know, you hear about Marines taking care of Marines. I mean, that's kind of what we do. And that was my first experience with that. And, you know, we were set to move back to Pennsylvania and I was going to go to Penn State. But we decided, you know, we stuck it out here. I hated every minute of it. I didn't enjoy that. Like anything business related whatsoever, like marketing, sales, logistics, any of it. I didn't like a damn bit of it. And I was worked there for like 8 months. And I had no clue what I was going to do. No clue what my career was going to be. No clue what my direction would be. I didn't know shit about shit, you know?
Right.
And I just knew I was not happy doing what I was doing.
Not exactly the way we draw it up.
No, not exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
But I will tell you this, pretty common because, you know, I'm going back to school. I don't need to have that much of a plan, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden, and the worst part is for you, you're married. Right. You have a boot on the back of your neck pressing.
Exactly.
And that's to me what a lot of guys don't think about you know, 12 to 24 months before they start getting out, is like, you know, maybe I should give this some thought, do a little financial preparation. And I think we do a better job at least teasing those things now. But you're kind
right.
of, you're kind of a poster child for what I would tell you is the way that three quarters of the Marine Corps gets out of the Marine Corps.
Oh yeah. The only dude, and I see it now with like the younger guys coming back when they, you know, when they get out, I mean, you know, they get out and, it's like, hey man, got my DD-214 and all of a sudden there's a picture on the internet with their DD-214 and
right.
like, you know, 300 empty beer bottles and stuff. And they're just, you know, and that's cool. Like I get it. You know, it was kind of, you know, when you leave, it was kind of like freeing, like, yeah, man, I can grow my hair. I can do this. I can do that. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, very shortly, like probably 6 months after I was out, I woke up in the morning, I had a beard and I had longer hair and I looked at myself and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, dude, you piece of shit? And get a fucking haircut. You know, I'm like having this conversation with myself in the mirror. I'm like, you look like a fucking shitbag. You know, and I went and got cleaned up and I went registered for college, you know? And, not really knowing what I was going to do, but, you know, like I think we talked previously, but, you know, I had a conversation with my dad. I'm like, you know, I'm going to be 30 when I would graduate from college. God, I don't know. Like, don't be an idiot. You're going to be 30 regardless. Like, you're either going to have a degree or not. Like, go to school. Don't be stupid. So, that's, you know.
I think we call that tough love. Somebody sober.
It was a really,
somebody no, no, sobering no, your no, dumb ass up.
It was a really tender moment. And so, but yeah, so I hit the school thing and I did, you know, I majored in history and, minored in political science because I was really interested in like international relations and foreign policy and that sort of stuff. And basically like I didn't think college math professors would let me use my fingers and toes, in class. So, I'm like, math's not for me. So, you know, did that and I ran into another Marine. This guy, Mike Bergner, he lives up in Bonsall. And if you've ever done the CrossFit world or associated with anything CrossFit, then you know the name Coach Bergner or Coach B or Mike Bergner. He's the guy who does, all the Olympic weightlifting, courses and training for, CrossFit. And at that time, Mike's an old Force Recon Marine. I think he got out in like 75.
Mm-hmm.
Bumped into him and got into a conversation and talked to him. I like to train a lot and PT a lot and bumped into him one day at lunch and got into a conversation with, as Marines do, they just bump into each other and start talking shit. And he invited me up to his house where he had a gym. And, I started training with him. And he was teaching me Olympic weightlifting. I was going to competitions and doing all that kind of stuff. And I did that the entire time while I was getting my undergrad. And it was through Mike that I first started thinking about teaching. Because Mike at that time was a high school teacher at Rancho Buena Vista High School here in San Diego County, North County of San Diego. So, and he actually got me hooked up with a job on the side where I was coaching, doing strength and conditioning coaching, and then coaching linebackers over at Vista High School, and I was doing that while I was going to college as well. I did a little substitute teaching, which was crazy, because that's an environment right there that I think like could really benefit from Marines or transitioning military folks, because it is so, so like the structure and the standards are so low for the students, it really, it's frightening.
Did you have any problems going in there as a former Marine? I coached high school baseball, and I was kind of nervous about that. And I had a teacher who had 35 years experience tell me, hey, you won't have a problem. I said,
yeah.
I'm kind of nervous about that. And he said, no, look, when you walk in there and you're serious and you tell them exactly what you want, they do not, and they know that there'll be consequences. They're not stupid. But if you're weak and you don't follow through, and then that's when people have problems. And was your experience similar?
I had a great time with the kids. I really enjoyed the kids because that's what I found. Like, they, especially Vista High School is kind of like a rougher side of the tracks kind of
right.
high school.
Right.
And the kids were used to running all over these teachers. I had a little bit of a benefit because I was dealing with the football program too. So one of the first experiences I had with those kids is I was in the weight room supervising these kids in the weight room, and I hadn't put them on a program or anything yet or started training them or anything. I was just kind of, you know, doing the platoon leader thing. Like, right. Hey, first couple of days, I'm just going to come in, shut the fuck up, and I'm going to observe, and I'm going to see what they do and how they, you know, what's working, what's not working kind of thing. And like second or third day, I was like, man, I've had it with this shit. I'm done observing. These guys are fucking driving me nuts. And I was in the weight room. The team captains are letting these guys do whatever. Nobody's in the same uniform. They're all running around, smoking and joking, dicking around, not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And, like, nobody's paying attention. They got their rap music going on and everything. So I walked in one corner and shut a door. Walked to the other, I shut the other door. Come back to the front and I shut the door. Now all the doors are shut. It's just me and the kids. So, and I grab a chair and I throw it up against the wall, like this folding chair, and I throw it up against the wall, like drill instructor style.
Nice.
And I just go, and basically that's what I did. It was like, it was treating them like a platoon. And I went ape shit. And fired all the team captains, got them up in front of everybody. I fired every single one of them because they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. They were all talking shit about how they wanted to win a championship, that they weren't willing to work hard, they weren't willing to do this, this, and that, whatever. And I said, if you guys don't want to do what you're supposed to do in here, get outside, get in the fire lane. And I had them in the fire lane behind the school, and I just had them, like, doing burpees and running wind sprints, like, on a whistle.
Right.
And, right. You know, they're freaking the fuck out. Like, they're losing their mind, and they're looking at me like I'm gonna. No, he's just joking. Like he's gonna stop
at some point. Yeah, this is just gonna be a little.
And I'm like, don't look at me. Get your fucking ass down there. My biggest thing that I was worried about was that I was sooner or later I was gonna swear enough to the point where they're gonna say, hey, man, like we just can't have you here talking.
Right.
Like
you gotta leave, man. You're not for here. You need to go someplace else.
Yeah, yeah. But I thrashed those guys. I thrashed those guys for like a good, probably a good 30, 40 minutes, like of a real good smoke session, you know? And then I got them in the, and then I sat them down back in the weight room again. And we sat down real quiet, and then I kind of put the senior drill instructor belt on.
Nice. You know? They have no idea what's coming either. You're just reeling
them all in. No, they don't even know. And I'm sitting here, you know, and I'm sitting there kind of like, well, damn, man, I really learned a lot from the Marine Corps. Like, wow, this is working great. And, you know, we just talked about commitment. We talked about all of our core values, honor, courage, and commitment. And I related that to the football experience and related that to performance and related some of the lessons that I learned in the Marine Corps to them. Like, look, guys, today, it starts today. You know, if you guys want to win a championship, we talked about, I remember my drill instructor, the two things my drill instructor that always have stayed with me is Staff Sergeant Paul Hughey. who I talked to many years ago, but I connected with him on Facebook. But he said, I remember him yelling at me one day, like getting up some hill or something, getting up some obstacle or something. I don't know. But I was getting thrashed. I wasn't doing well, and I was falling down or whatever the hell I was doing. And he was like, Seeker, nobody wants to hear your fucking sob story. Get the fuck up that obstacle, you know? And I'm like, yeah, I like that. And that's a phrase I use all the time, or a phrase that I tell myself, like, nobody wants to hear your fucking sob story. Like, I don't want to hear it. You don't want to hear it. Just shut the fuck up and do something about it, you know? And then the other thing that I remember him saying all the time was discipline creates performance. Because he would have us say that while we were doing push-ups, and he'd be smoking us on the quarterdeck. And that was kind of the theme that we based that season on, was discipline creates performance, right? You don't get anything without hard work. People don't just give shit to you. You don't just get to wear fancy clothes. You don't just get to get a championship ring or whatever, you know, that sort of thing, just cause. You don't work for it. You got to earn it. And everybody's got to do their part. And I said, if you don't want to do your part, and you think you're an individual, and you think you're better than everybody else in here, and you're not willing to commit to what we got in store for the next however many months, get the fuck out. There's the door. And not one of those kids left. And they loved it. They ate that shit up. And,
you know, it's the structure of success. There's no way.
Yeah.
And you cannot be successful without it. You know,
no, you can try hard,
but it ain't happening.
Yeah, and that story went around the school like wildfire the next day. And then all the kids were like, hey, coach, you know, they love that. They just love that structure.
Right.
And they loved being part of something special, you know, and, you know, you can create that yourself. You don't have to have somebody tell you that or anything. I mean, you just create it through discipline and hard work. And, we won CIF championships that year. And I think the following year too, we won three, with those same kids, man. We just, like, nobody's going to come to our house and beat us. Like, we will crush you. You know?
And those are life lessons, just like you learned them, and we all learned them in boot camp. The sad part is there's a lot of people that either aren't willing or afraid to teach those in public schools, and so kids walk out of there without that skill set, without understanding what that discipline is, one of the secrets to life. And if you don't embrace it, man, you're going to struggle.
You're going to suck it. Yeah, for sure. You see that now with, you know, lowering standards so everybody gets a thumbs up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, man, have I succeeded in everything that I've done in my life? Fuck no. I've had a rough go of it. You know, we've all had those times where we've had a rough go of it. We've all fallen down and smacked our face on the pavement, you know? But if you don't teach kids that that's a normal process, and that hey, this is how you deal with failure, like you learn from it and you adjust your plan and you move forward, God, man, you're doing them a huge disservice, you know?
No, absolutely. My guest is Steve. Say your last name.
Seeker.
Seaper. All right.
Yep.
Steve Seaker, and former Sergeant Marine Corps Scout Sniper. We're talking about his transition, and we're going to take a quick break. Steve, when we come back, we'll talk about your life as a cop, and then want to talk about how you get into Hollywood. How does that happen for you? Because a lot of Marines, are very interested in the entertainment business, so I want to hear what you have to say about it. So, Steve, interesting life, and interesting life lessons, and essentially the same ones that we all learn, and he's obviously furnishing. So we're going to take a quick break on a Thursday when we're talking transition. And you're listening to not a very good one that through the strength of effort turns into a good one, which I would tell you is more typical Marine than anything else. So we'll take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do. And I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
All I can say about militarybyowner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
.9 here on a Thursday, transition Thursday. We're talking transitions. And we're joined by a man who's had an interesting career and an interesting life, former Marine, sergeant, and got out of the Marine Corps in 1995, and Steve Siebker. So, Steve, so you're moving around, and you get introduced. A friend of yours tells you about the police department, and you go for a ride along. And does it appear just to be a natural fit for you at the time? Even you, and I almost said even with your college education, but it's almost like you're going to go back into the Marine Corps in some way, shape, or form. Yes.
Yeah, you know, I'd avoided a lot of my buddies. Had immediately transitioned from the Marine Corps and had gone into law enforcement right away, and had talked to me initially about doing that with them, and I'd avoided that because I really wanted to get my education. I said, you know, and I wanted to be sure that I wasn't just doing that because, hey, it's a uniform, it's a weapon, and that structure, and I wasn't doing it just because it was familiar. I wanted to see what else was out there, and but yeah, my good friend, Rob DeArmond, he's a retired Marine, scout sniper. He's my roommate. As a matter of fact, I just, was out in Palm Springs at his wedding, over the weekend. He's been on LAPD, God, over 20 years now. He's getting ready to retire, but Rob's like, dude, you gotta do, like, I'm telling you, you're gonna enjoy it.
But, you know, let me ask you, I think there's a difference, and I have friends that are, like most Marines, I have friends that are cops, right?
Right.
There's a paranoia associated with being a cop that I don't think we live with in the Marine Corps. How did you navigate that, you know, because you deal with you know, the jackasses, right? Mm-hmm. You deal with a lot of people with mental health issues. I mean, so you're dealing with the problems of the city every day, and it tends to affect you over the course of the long term. How did you navigate that?
You know, it's interesting you say that. They talk a lot about it in law enforcement, you know, hypervigilance.
Right.
If you read any of Dave Grossman's books, Colonel Dave Grossman's books on combat, on killing, it talks a lot about that too.
Right.
It just comes with the territory. It's like everywhere you go, you're always watching people's hands, pockets, their waistbands. Like, oh, that, you know, and you get to this point where like after a few years, you're already like, everybody you meet, you assume is a piece of shit right off the bat.
Right.
Until proven otherwise.
Right.
That's a really good question. How did I deal with that? I don't know if I really did. It just, I was conscious of it, and I tried to deal with it. My wife was very conscious of it. My wife would be, you know, everywhere we went. I couldn't drive anywhere on a day off with my wife and not make some sort of comment of, look at that piece of shit over there, or yeah, that dude's on parole.
Right.
Oh, that's a gang member over there, or,
right.
Oh, man, you know, or something like that. And a lot of times it was just an unconscious comment. You know, it was just, well, yeah, I mean, look, he is a piece of shit. I mean, look at him.
No, it's,
you know,
you're taking her into your world, a glimpse of your world, right?
Yeah, you know, and you're seeing the shitty parts of everybody's life. I mean, if you think about it, like, any time you have, like, if you want to be a hero and you want to be loved by everybody, I'll tell you, if we're talking transitions here, just FYI for any of you guys transitioning or guys or gals transitioning, you want to be loved by people and things like that, be a firefighter.
Yeah. Let me tell you, you eat good, you save people, everybody loves you, and nobody ever quits the fire department.
Right, right.
Ever.
Exactly.
It's too good.
I mean, if you think about cops, I mean, if I'm interacting with you, it's a bad day for you. Whether or not you're the crook and you're getting arrested, or you're a regular citizen and I'm telling you, you got your shit stolen, you know, or right. Whatever. So it's always, yeah, that can get frustrating. I mean, but I felt like it was a really, really worthwhile job. I really enjoyed plugging in. I mean, it's like going on patrol anywhere, you know, like once you go outside the wire, it's like you suit up and you go, and then it's that hypervigilance, that kind of, I don't know, some people describe it as a buzz or electric feeling or whatever, however they describe it. Like, it's a good feeling. It's cool, you know?
It turns you into one of those miserable cops that nobody wants to be around.
In particular,
his wife. So how did you avoid that, or did you? Does your wife still want to be around you?
You know, I mean, not all the time. You know, not all the time. I mean, especially when I worked, I worked narcotics, and I worked homicides. When I was working as a detective, I was on the phone all the time. I was gone all the time. Working a wiretap case, we would do, and, you know, I'd get called out. I'd get a phone call at 2:00 in the morning. Like, all my kit was lined up in my room. You know, so I could jump into my clothes and holster up my pistol, grab my overnight bag and my body armor, and be out the door. Because, hey, we got to do surveillance, or we're going to go hit this house, or we're going to go do, you know, whatever. And, or, hey, you know, I need you down at the border right now. Or, hey, we're following these people to Fresno right now, you know, or whatever. So, that, I mean, that got old. I mean, it was really, initially, it's super cool. It's like, wow, I get to wear blue jeans and plain clothes, and I get to, I'm Sonny Crockett, man. It's Miami Vice, bro. You know, this is shit.
Right.
And then, you know, that, the long hours and all that kind of stuff, it definitely grinds on you. And Homicide's even more because, you know, you're spending a lot of time with death,
right,
and bodies, and you're doing autopsies.
Right.
You're seeing child deaths. You're right. Seeing a lot of really, really traumatic stuff.
Right.
And it's not just like, oh, I see it and then I walk away from it. It's like, okay, here's the dead body. And now I'm going to spend the next fucking, you know, 20 hours here processing this crime scene. So I'm going to be here with this body for a while. You know what I mean? And I'm going to be looking very closely at everything around and all that kind of stuff. So, that grinds on you, man.
All right. So when do you leave? When do you leave the police force?
I left almost 3 years ago now.
Okay.
I got this crazy opportunity through a friend of mine is Kurt Johnstadt. And Kurt Johnstadt, if you're a movie geek, you will know that Kurt Johnstadt works with Zack Snyder quite a bit, who's a director. And they did, Kurt wrote 300. He wrote 300 Rise of the Empire. He wrote Act of Valor. And he's got some other cool, he's been writing on the new Aquaman movie that's going to come out. Got some other cool things in the works coming up.
Right.
And I met Kurt at a shooting course. I went to a 3-day pistol course when I was still a cop and bumped into Kurt, and we became friends. We've been friends probably, gosh, I don't know, 10, 12 years, something like that. And Kurt called me up one day and had a guy by the name of John Lavin, who is also a writer, and he was revamping the shooter series, the shooter movie.
Okay.
that Mark Wahlberg did, which was based on Stephen Hunter's Bob Lee Swagger novels, Point of Impact. And he was redoing that for television. And he wanted to talk to somebody from the Marine Sniper community and get some – they wanted to kind of update it and make Bob Lee an Afghan vet, a MARSOC guy, and that sort of stuff. So, well, sure, I'll sit down and talk to him. And John bought me lunch. We sat down and chatted about it. And next thing you know, he's emailing me his scripts while he's developing the pilot, because he's trying to sell the pilot to Paramount Television. He's sending me his scripts where I'm helping him work on some of the language, some of the uniforms and the technical stuff or what have you. And he sells it. He calls me up and he's like, hey man, guess what? We sold it. Like, Paramount bought it. They want to make it. Whoa. Like, hey, good for you, bro. He's like, no, man. Like, good for us. Like, I want you, we're going to Vancouver for a month. I want you to be my technical advisor. And at that time I was, you know, I was kind of like, well, hey, that's cool, but what is that?
So what else do you have? What else do you have going now? At that time, you obviously, you know, so far in the conversation, never have I heard you say, I've always been an aspiring technical advisor, you know, to Hollywood and things like that. I missed that part of the interview.
I've never in a million years thought I would actually be doing that. I read a ton. I read Hemingway is my favorite author. I read a lot of fiction, nonfiction, a lot of international affairs stuff. And I read a lot of, Stoic philosophy, Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, that sort of thing. Seneca, I'm reading a bunch of Ryan Holiday's stuff right now, which is really good. The Obstacle is the Way, which I think is, I think that's a really good one for anyone doing transitions. I think would be a great book.
Who's the author?
His name is Ryan Holiday.
Ryan Holiday. Okay.
Yeah. And it's The Obstacle is the Way. And because I kind of got into him through Stephen Pressfield's books, started reading a lot of Stephen Pressfield's books. Stephen Pressfield's also a former Marine, if you didn't know that. I'd always done creative writing kind of on my own, journals and things like that, just for myself. But I never thought like I'd ever share that with anybody or actually write a script or even be involved in that process. And this opportunity kind of came down the pike. John and I started talking about the money, and he's like, "Hey man, I want you to come to Vancouver." And I thought, you know what, man, like this, you can't be conservative. You can't create momentum in your life, right? And successful momentum without taking risk, right? I think our society has become so risk averse, that a lot of times we, like you see people just like, no one will make a decision. Like they're afraid to take responsibility. They're afraid to fail. And I think without failure, you can't have great success. Because no one is successful. Like they just say, "Hey, I'm going to be a screenwriter." And they go, "Da, da, 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 I'm a screenwriter." And they write something, somebody buys it, and they make it, and they make $300 million. Like, that doesn't happen.
How does it happen?
Like my friend Kurt. I mean, Kurt lived in his van for a while in L.A., and he ate ramen. And he, you know what I mean? Like, you grind. You grind.
So that whole process, it kind of thrashes out the faint of heart or people that are marginally committed. Yes?
I think so, because I think what ends up happening is I'm a book recommending guy, and okay. No, I'm not getting any proceeds of any of these, but The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield is fantastic. It's a super easy read. You'd probably read it in a day, maybe 200 pages or something, but he talks about resistance and what all of the things that we tell ourselves so that we don't achieve what we want to achieve. And at some point, nobody's going to create the momentum for you. Nobody's going to give you anything, you know. At some point, you've got to make a decision and you've got to commit. You have to sit down and do work, period. No way around it. So kind of to get back to, because we're kind of getting off of the Vancouver thing, but
we'll get back to it. Trust me.
Yeah. I just think like you've always got to be moving forward. You know what I mean? Like you cannot let your circumstances determine your fate. Like you have ultimate control over your fate. For people struggling with transition, struggling with PTSD, or struggling with any of those things, you know, some of the traumas and TBIs and things like that, and all those kinds of things. I've met so many amazing folks, and the one thing that's common in all of these people that are considered now like top performers, right? Is they've all been kicked in the nuts multiple times. Like multiple times. Not even kicked in the nuts. Like sledgehammers to the nuts, right? And the one thing that is consistently true with all of these people is that they all made a decision and said, "Fuck you. That's not where it ends. That's not where it ends for me. This is not who I, you know, this is not who I am. This is the direction I'm going to go, and I'm going to fucking drive on." And they, you know, they take the initiative and they fucking drive forward. And when I look at that, it always amazes me, because that's like day one Marine Corps shit, you know? And anytime I've ever faced, you know, adversity in my life, I've always reverted, it sounds weird, and I'm sure like all of the fans of like Terminal Lance or whatever, like, be like, you're such a fucking douchebag. But anytime I've ever faced adversity in my life, like, I've always gone back to, and looked at my guidebooks for Marines, right? Where I've looked at,
you know what? They're not laughing because, look, as much as they laugh, why did they just not turn the page and let it go? Because they love that shit.
Yeah,
it's important to
them. Yeah.
So they can play it off like it's bullshit, and we'll all make jokes about it. But guess what? They live it. Yeah. They hear it, and that's why it's so funny.
And by the way, I love Terminal Lance. I think it's fucking hilarious.
It is funny. Like, it's true,
so,
right?
It's so fucking on point. It's ridiculous. Across generations, but yeah, I look at my old FM-, whatever the hell, Leading Marines or whatever I think it's called. I can't even remember the FM number, but I still have those copies. And whenever I've faced adversity, like, I go back and I've looked at those lessons and I remind myself of who I am at the core, like my foundation, right? I'm a fucking Marine, man. I don't fucking quit for shit, you know? If I need help, I'll find help. If I need somebody to help me, or if I need knowledge, I will seek that out, and I will do what I need to do to make this shit happen, because I get shit done, because that's what Marines do. We get shit done. Whether that's, I don't know, you know, whether that's scrubbing the floor for my wife while she's at work, or... which seems like a lot of what I do lately, but or writing my own scripts or things like that. So, you know, that's what I love about, and I think all Marines kind of love about that Marine Corps experience, is no matter where you wind up in your life, whether you stay in the Marine Corps, retire from the Marine Corps after 30-some years, or you're a four-star general, you become or Secretary of Defense, or whatever, or you wind up working at a gas station, or you wind up wherever.
We pretty much own the federal government. We all know that now. Right. And it's about time.
Right.
It's about time.
Yeah.
Stand by to be unfucked, everybody, just so we're clear.
I'm telling you, if I have to watch another fucking movie about SEAL Team 6, I'm going to fucking puke my fucking guts out.
You know, we've been having some discussions about that. You know, I'm curious about your thoughts. So we'll get back to Vancouver here in a minute, but give me 60,
sure.
Give me 60 seconds of thought. You know what? Why are there no movies on Delta Force? There's no major books about Delta Force. Delta Force, not constantly in the news. Delta Force, there's no, we don't see the big disasters around Delta Force. Is there something to that? Is there a crisis in the SEAL community with this kind of, lust for, to be glamorized and to constantly, what happened to Swift, Silent, and Deadly? I think they're having a little bit of a crisis in their own community. Yay, nay?
Yeah, you know what? I don't know. I think there's some truth to that. I mean, I know some guys, some close friends of mine are team guys. I know some guys from, that had worked at DevGrew, who are all amazing, amazing human beings. I mean, you wouldn't even hesitate to stand shoulder to shoulder with these guys. But there is something to be said for quiet professionalism. And I don't know why. I think the Navy made some decisions public relation wise to maybe up recruitment for Navy Special Warfare or Naval Special Warfare. And I think some of those public relation decisions now are biting them in the ass, because now everybody wants a book and everybody wants a movie and things like that. And yeah, I don't know.
Here's a theory that's been forwarded on this program. The path to Delta and Army Special Forces runs through ground combat units for the most part. And they can come from all branches, but you go in to be a soldier, and then maybe you want to be a SF guy, but you know how you prove yourself. And so when you become a SEAL, right, you become, you're kind of a SEAL from birth. You go in as with the mindset, I'm a special operator. You go through, you know, their program and whatnot, but you're never anything else. You're never just another sailor. And so the theory that has been espoused is they're kind of that way, in terms of it's what they like, it's what they gravitate towards, and there is no kind of mollifying effect by service, by in other arms of your own branch that kind of tethers you to the service. They are special people. They are SEALs, and there's a thing that goes with that. They don't know anything else. And it's kind of an interesting theory that they're special from the start. And I will tell you this. I do think they're having a – when you read some of the stuff that is they debate, they are having a little bit of a crisis about it, that what happened to Swift, Silent, and Deadly? When did we become media whores? And what happened to our sense of professionalism that characterized being a SEAL for so many years, and why are we like this now? So it's a pretty interesting discussion.
I think it is interesting, because in some regards too, like some of those, I think there's some truth to that, man, because that is, I mean, they do like that. It's like, we don't fucking lose, you know, fucking. And we're Navy SEALs. We're Navy SEALs. It's we're SEALs.
Right.
So yeah, there's not a lot of identification with the naval service itself. It's almost like, well, I wouldn't join the Navy. I don't really want to be in the Navy. Like, I want to be a SEAL.
Right.
That's different. Yeah.
Which is almost the complete opposite when you say to one of us, "Are you in the military?" And the response, I'm a Marine.
No, I'm a Marine. Exactly.
That's the response.
Yeah.
We're talking transitions, kind of, here, among other things, on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. My guest is Steve Siepker, and Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, got out in 1995, Scout Sniper, went on to work with the Carlsbad Police Department, and now does technical advising in Hollywood. Steve, an email for you, and then we've got to take a quick break. And can you hang with us to the top of the hour?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I've got plenty of time.
All right. Email says this. Hey, Mac, I'm interested in the entertainment business. It seems like you have to be a little bit lucky to get your snout underneath one of the panels of the tent. And Steve sounds like he wasn't really looking for it. It simply came his direction. Does he have any advice for those of us who would like to either write or to somehow or other be involved in productions, in terms of an entry point to that business, which seems so very difficult to find? So I'm sure you've been asked that before.
And I think that's really, really accurate. Well, first off, I appreciate the email. Secondly, sure. That's super accurate. It did kind of fall in my lap, for sure. And, you know, I'm still in the very early stages of continuing to make that work for me and continue to drive down that road. So as far as writing, like my suggestion is, if you want to put this person in touch with me, I could certainly start pointing them in the, I don't know if they've already, if when they said they wanted to be involved in the entertainment business, and you talk about writing and productions, I mean, those are two very different things. Do you want to be a producer? Or do you want to be a writer? Do you want to be a writer? You know, which road do you want to travel down? You can be a writer producer, but only after having been a writer. So there's a bunch of different ways you can do it, but I would definitely say you would want to be able to relocate to Hollywood for sure, or to the Los Angeles area. There's plenty of production companies I could, you know, you can plug in with and try and get hired on. If you're interested in production and how that works, get hired on. Typically the entry level position is a production assistant. Can you get hired on, and work that? And then you can work up kind of the chain, into from production assistant. You can either branch off. That'll get you exposure to the industry and get you exposed to, you know, you'll see the camera department working. You'll see the grip department working. You'll see the art department working. And you'll understand all these different departments.
Hold on. What is the grip department? I see that all the time. I don't know what a grip is.
Yeah. And I never knew what a grip was either. But grips, typically, they're on set, and their job is to basically they move a lot of, I'm forgetting the technical term for what these things are, but basically these kind of like big shields or whatever to assist in the lighting and the reflection of light.
Right.
In the different camera shots. So they're always moving stuff around. And, if the cameras need, some sort of support or boxes or a platform or something to shoot from to get a certain angle or whatever to grips, all of a sudden you'll see like four or five guys like putting something together, like with a bunch of drills and stuff, zip, 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 and they've got it all put together, you know. But getting back to those, I would recommend trying to get a job as a production assistant initially. And play it forward from there. But
does the entertainment business like Marines?
I think the entertainment, in my experience, I think the entertainment business, they like people that work hard, and they like people that have integrity and have a bit of character, because the entertainment business doesn't have a lot of that.
And we lost power right there. So, we will pick up this interview tomorrow. Steve Sepke has been gracious enough to join us. However, we don't control the power. And so, we will pick up with this interview tomorrow at 10 o'clock Pacific time. So, Steve Sepke, we'll pick it up tomorrow at 8 o'clock Pacific time. And we'll find out the rest of the story. Steve, interesting guy, from Marine to law enforcement, now to technical consulting in the entertainment business. So, with apologies for the issue, but it happens. All Marine Radio will continue right after this here on the All Warrior Radio Network.